Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm very pleased to say we have Sandy Zipp on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Manhattan Projects, The Rise and Fall of Urban Renewal in Cold War New York. Anyone who has ever lived in New York City, and particularly on the island of Manhattan, knows what the expression pre-war building means. It means, first of all, a building that is more desirable than other buildings, namely post-war buildings. Pre-war buildings have a kind of cachet that post-war buildings do not. Pre-war buildings tend to be a bit less modernist, I guess I would say, than post-war buildings. Pre-war buildings tend to be a little bit more ornate, whereas post-war buildings are a little bit more blocky. Sandy Zipp's book, Manhattan Projects, does a lot to explain why this distinction is so important for people that live in Manhattan. And the reason is largely urban renewal, or a specific wave of urban renewal that started during World War II. Many of the projects that Sandy discusses will be known to you, three in particular. That is Stuyvesant Town, Lincoln Center, and then the various large housing complexes on the Upper East Side all the way into Harlem. You see these places when you wander around the East Village, or when you walk up Broadway in the case of Lincoln Center, or when you take the train down from New Haven on Metro North. They don't look like other places in Manhattan. They look like what Americans now call projects. Sandy tells the story of how they came to be, how the very well-intentioned people who built them put the deals together to clear the slums and to make life better for people in the areas. It's also part of the story about how New York went from an industrial city to an almost entirely, I guess I would call it, commercial or residential city, a place where things were built and made and killed to a place where money changed hands and services were proffered. It's also a story of wealth and a story of poverty. It's a story of race, lots of different angles. It's about the remaking of Manhattan and the Manhattan that you see today. It's a terrific book. I hope that you get a chance to read it. I enjoyed talking to Sandy today, and without further delay, here's the interview. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. I hope that you're well today. Today we have Sandy Zipp on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific book, Manhattan Projects, The Rise and Fall of Urban Renewal in Cold War New York. I was telling Sandy in the pre-interview that one of the things that caught my attention when I first went to Manhattan many years ago, I was traveling from the north, from New Haven to Manhattan, and you pass through an area that looks for all the world like the Soviet Union, that there are large, large housing blocks like people in the Soviet Union live in, and I always wondered how exactly they got there. I was vaguely aware that it was related to urban renewal, but until I read Sandy's book, I just didn't really know anything about it. I just thought it was an architectural oddity. But again, thanks to Sandy's fine book, I now know a lot more about it. And it is a very interesting story, and Sandy will tell it to us today. But before he does, Sandy, would you do us the favor of telling us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me.
My pleasure.
You know, I was born in Washington, D.C., actually, not New York. I'm not actually a native New Yorker. I grew up in Washington, and I attended public schools there, and like most middle-class kids, went off to college, and where I did an undergraduate degree in American Studies at Northwestern University, where we called it then the Program in American Culture. And I was sort of kicking about for a couple of years, a few years after college, working in and out of journalism, writing, things like that, and more or less involved in music scenes and things like that. I had always sort of wanted to be a writer, had always been interested in music. I published my own magazine. Cool. So living in San Francisco for a number of years, working as bike messenger, doing a whole bunch of things that got me sort of interested in cities and trying to put together my sort of interest in city life, my interest in music, culture, history. And I eventually decided to go back to graduate school and went back to graduate school in American Studies. And a few years later, began working on the dissertation that became this book. So I ended up at Yale University in American mm-hmm. Studies, where I mm-hmm. worked on this book. I started actually at George Washington University mm-hmm. in American Studies back home in D.C., mm-hmm. but moved on to Yale and began to...
You You probably took that train from New Haven.
Many times. Yes, right. Lived in New York for a great deal of the time that I was working on this book, doing the research.
Yeah, I imagine you did. And you see, I'm sure that many of our listeners have seen the same thing, that you go from New Haven to, what's that place called, that station, North something? It's called Metro North, isn't it? Yeah,
it's the Metro North line. That comes down through the Bronx and across the river and into East Harlem. And there's a sort of pretty amazing vista that opens up as you cross the Bronx River there.
It really is amazing. So we'll get to understand how that vista came to be, which is really cool. So why don't you tell us why you wrote this book? How did you come to write this book?
Well, it's a good question. I have often asked myself that same thing. I was casting about during graduate school for something to write on. I had become newly fascinated with New York. Growing up in Washington, one has this kind of sense of New York. It sort of looms in the northern horizon and in everyone's imagination as a kind of, it sort of looms there all the time. And I'd taken it for granted. Had been there before, but had never kind of let it get its hooks in me. And as I said, after college, I had moved in the opposite direction self-consciously chosen not to go to New York, despite my interest in writing and despite my interest in music and all those sorts of things that often brings one to New York, and had gone to San Francisco instead. But something about New York got into my mind. We would go there, friends of mine, to see bands and to do other things. In those years, during college and after, during various times, and I don't know, I just had gotten fascinated with New York. And here I was in New Haven and then living in New York after that in Brooklyn. And I was trying to search around for something to write about. And I also wanted to write about something that allowed me to think about the relationships between ideas and culture and social life and politics, to try to forge some kind of constellation of meaning between these realms that historians, I think, often keep separate. Having all my education in American studies programs, I guess I have 3 degrees in American studies now. I work in an American studies program now, but I consider myself a historian. I've sort of been able to keep at arm's length some of the kind of turf battles that happen amongst historians between, particularly as I see it, I'm sure there are many more of these, but many finer distinctions, but particularly between the social and political historians that have sort of dominated the proceedings in history for the last, 10 or 15 years, and cultural and intellectual historians who perhaps had more cachet a few years before that, and the sort of debate over who makes history, right? And I remember many conversations with folks in graduate school, and particularly in history departments, who would say, it's ordinary people who make history. And then, you'd talk to somebody who's interested in diplomatic history or something like that, and they would say, well, no, of course. I mean, that's nice to think that, but it's the decision makers. It's the people with power make history. And us over in our little corner in American studies, we were sort of always churning over a bunch of sort of obscure concepts about discourse and culture and sort of far more abstract ways of understanding the way that that change happens. And I wanted to try to figure out how to bring all those together. I think implicitly. I don't think I could yet sort of say that explicitly. I was still trying to work it out. And it's only now later that I see that that's one of the things that was motivating me to try to create some kind of triangulation between these realms. Mm-hmm. And so I was casting about for some material with which to do that. I had always been fascinated with the sort of reach and power of modernist ideas, whether it was in various forms of the arts, or particularly when it was interested in city making or city remaking. And so, of course, the sort of moment for this, the kind of moment where these ambitions reach their height, is the moment of urban renewal, the moment at mid-century where it's often been said planners and architects were turned loose to remake cities, to uproot old urban forms with warehouses and apartment buildings and row houses and the old 19th century cityscape and replace them with this newer this newer sort of modern built environment of plazas and towers, and I, you know, this was already something that was more or less understood. And so I approached it somewhat warily because I felt like this was a story that we sort of knew the outlines of. We had a kind of pat sort of takeaway that we could already apply to this history. It had been kind of written a generation before in some ways by social scientists. We had a sort of story, particularly for New York, where it was the kind of evil Robert Moses versus the sort of scruffy... the scruffy rebellion of someone like a Jane Jacobs and her Death and Life of Great American Cities. Mm-hmm. And these kind of oppositions were very much chiseled into stone, and they were very much, and they were really chiseled into stone amongst New Yorkers, too. This is a sort of folklore of a set of myths and a set of stories that New Yorkers carried with them, the sort of tower versus the streets, the neighborhood, the city of neighborhoods and stoops and blocks versus the towers and the plazas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wary of going this far into it. I wanted to try to write something that tried to get to that story, but to expand it in some new ways. And I began by trying to write a more sort of metropolitan conception of this, to see this in relationship to suburbs. And to its and the relationship that the city had to its expanding hinterlands, which was an important thing to understand and continues to be an important thing to understand for urban historians. But that soon proved to be far too unwieldy, and I ended up figuring that I needed to focus more concretely on particular places.
Mm-hmm.
So. Instead of making people the characters in my book, I decided to focus on some particular places and make places the characters in my book. And I saw there's a trade-off. I knew that there would be sort of costs and benefits to having to focus in. So I ended up focusing in on Manhattan, which is one of the things that I regret, but which I think was necessary in that it actually ended up opening up a sort of broader scope for the book. So it actually ended up allowing me to make larger, make some larger claims for the significance of what was going on in New York because of these things being situated in Manhattan, where we have such a concentration of image making and news making and significance making already happening. Right? So thereby these things that were happening to transform Manhattan in these years, in the 20 years after World War II, become refracted and reflected and sort of, what's the word, echoed or,
mm-hmm.
What's the word I'm looking for? You know, they're made louder by the fact that there's lots of people there to think and talk and make images of them.
Amplify, that's what we want, yeah.
Amplify is the word.
Sorry, I was blanking too.
It was there somewhere. So I kind of circled in around and I basically I remember saying this to someone as I was circling in around the topic. I said, I think what I'm trying to do in the end is I think I've figured out that what I'm doing is writing a cultural history of urban renewal,
mm-hmm.
which was a sort of odd thing to say because for anyone who had thought about urban renewal, and particularly for historians, urban renewal was, on the one hand, this sort of open and shut case. It was something that we understood, we had put into a box, and we had kind of put away. On the other hand, it was not a cultural story. It was a kind of social and political story. The only new things that had been said about urban renewal were being said by social and political historians who had really delved into the way that it interlinked with larger processes of post-World War II transformation in cities. So there was starting to be, this is early 2000s, late 90s, when I was thinking through all these things, there had started to be a whole new wave of urban historians, in post-war urban historians. So Arnold Hirsch would have been the first of them who had first come out with his book in the 80s, but had redone it in the late 90s. Thomas Segrew, my colleague Robert Self, who were remaking how we thought about cities. And for them, urban renewal was simply one little aspect of a much larger story of metropolitan transformation, of struggle between social movements, of attempts to social movements and to influence liberalism, the kind of struggle to move, influence the movement of capital, whether it was in or out of cities, all kinds of larger sort of stories that circulated about around relations between social movements and the state. And I appreciated this literature, and still do, and I think it's enormously important, but I was interested in the ideas, and I couldn't figure out quite how the ideas, the culture of this, the meanings that circulated around this, which were clearly there for people, could relate to those other stories, those larger stories that started to pull out. And everybody just kind of, you could tell this story through a sort of architectural history or a planning history, right? And that had always been there too, which was just simply to say the rise of modernism and the fall of modernism. Again, the sort of Moses Jacobs thing. The Le Corbusier makes big towers. They come to New York. Everybody finds them to be overwhelming and rises up and resists them. And I think that story is not wrong either. But how could it be that these two things fit together? And I wasn't yet sure how to make them fit together, so I sort of waded into it and tried to understand how to write these two sort of narratives together and see how they might change when they did. Mm-hmm. And working through these spaces that I selected, which I thought were sort of, I came to think of them as my iconic Manhattan projects. They're the places that really that I think were the places that really transformed. And I also got onto this idea, and this is where the title comes from. Although I have to, the title, all credit to the title goes to my advisor and dissertation director, Jean-Christophe Agnew, who suggested it to me one day in one of our earliest meetings on this. He said, "Well, of course you'll call this book Manhattan Projects." Uh-huh. And I said, "Of course, you're right, I will." all credit goes to him on that. He has the mind that creates things like that. I think one of the things that became interesting to me was what role did the domestic political culture of the Cold War play in this? Because, and that became a big part of this story. This was in the late 90s and early 2000s, there were a lot of books coming out about that question in different aspects of American social and political and cultural life. So we had books about desegregation as a Cold War imperative, I think was the major article written by Mary Dudziak, things like that showed the way that the geopolitics of the Cold War had a domestic front and how they influenced various kinds of struggles within the country as well. There are all sorts of things that way. Books on the family, blanking on the name of that, Homeward Bound. All sorts of books like that were fairly influential. And I wondered, was there a story here about the influence of the Cold War? And it turned out that there was. It turned out that there was a kind of sort of buried but significant current of thinking and argument and debate that accessed the terms of the Cold War, that went through the question, through the history of urban rule, through the rise and fall of this thing. So what I ended up doing, I think, and what I found myself doing was to try to show how these four different projects transformed the city space of Manhattan, transformed people's ideas about cities, and to see these four projects as a lens through which urban renewal as an idea itself rose and fell, was made and then unmade. Mm-hmm. And so it was about a kind of spatial account of the transformation in an idea, the rise and fall of this idea, and how people fought over making urban renewal the sort of conception of the sort of common sense conception of how to change cities for the better, and how that idea itself was undermined by the impact of urban renewal itself. So that was the sort of major way that I arrived. And I think in the end, I think of there being sort of four basic sort of noteworthy intellectual contributions that the Manhattan Project makes. And I guess the first is to try to view urban renewal explicitly from the perspective of cultural history, seeing it as not only sort of a part of social and political history, but as a sort of major symbolic element in our understandings of urban life in post-World War II. So as a kind of a disturbance in the realm of meaning as well as much as in the realm of sort of social and political life, and to insist that we be able to see those elements of change over time as related to one another, as in some kind of an interesting and functional relationship. So that would be the first. Mm-hmm. The second would be that this is something I haven't quite talked too much about yet, but that the resistance to urban renewal the forces that arose to unmake urban renewal were not just didn't just sort of arise in the 1960s out of nowhere, or with, say, for instance, Jane Jacobs' book *Death and Life of Great American Cities*, which is sort of the kind of sort of uninvestigated assumption that I think a lot of people have had for many years about how urban renewal was undone. No one had really done the history to understand how this happened. But what I discovered was that there were a host of different movements, and I'm not the first person to have noticed this, but I think I and a number of other people who are starting to write histories of this right now are starting to know, are starting to try to spell out this history in a little bit more detail. It's just, and it was to suggest that this history really started along with urban renewal itself in the late 40s and early 50s, and grew along with urban renewal until it finally became powerful enough to unseat those ideas. So what I try to do in my book, is to tell a little bit of the sort of backstory, the story behind the rise of a figure like Jane Jacobs, who's very important and very powerful figure in unseating urban renewal because of her incredible and really dazzling impact of that, of Death and Life of Great American Cities, which is a classic work of American literature, but is also, and so it has this great impact. But there is this whole set of social movements and other kinds of folks who are working on this issue really kind of before she arrives on the scene, and from whom she learns a lot and picks up on. So I wanted to sort of give a sense of that story. So in some sense, Jacobs is at the end of my book instead of the beginning. Mm-hmm. So that's the second one. The third would be that I wanted us to understand urban renewal as a crucial event in the rise of what we now call the global city, right? That in some sense, it's both heralding and laying the groundwork for the rise of a sort of world city, and also that it heralds the rise of what we in the 60s called the urban crisis, and that these two things, this paradox, that urban renewal is at the heart of both the city's sort of greatest power and its greatest failings, is what's so interesting about urban renewal, that it underwrites both the creation of a white-collar economy in the Manhattan cityscape that will give allow New York to be transformed and survive the years of the deindustrialization that destroyed so many other cities, like particularly the cities that, of the West that you referenced earlier, that it'll allow it to sort of outlast those, but also that it will, in some ways, urban renewal will actually provide much of the discontent, or underwrite much of the discontent in terms of racial segregation, other kinds of displacement that people have to experience and go through, and that is at the heart of some of what we called in the 1960s the urban crisis, and that these two processes are linked, intimately linked together. And finally, again, just the context of the Cold War, to see that the Cold War was both a motivating factor in the ways that people pitched the idea of urban renewal, seeing it as a bulwark in a domestic campaign to kind of shore up domestic readiness for this battle with the Soviet Union, the sort of battle of images and ideas, and that we were undergoing in the late 40s and into the 50s and 60s, and also then that people who resisted urban renewal drew on some of these same kinds of narratives about the Cold War, but inverted them and said, look, why are we creating these places, just as you said, that look like the Soviet Union? Why are we creating places that are supposed to be modern and new, but seem far more evocative of our supposedly totalitarian enemy, who want nothing to do with the kind of freedom and individualism that we're supposed to embody in our built environment? And so that those folks wanted to roll that back and undo it. And so you have a kind of shared investment in the language of the Cold War, but from different perspectives, which work to help to make and unmake urban renewal.
Maybe we should start. Thank you for that. Let's start talking a little bit about the people that did this and opposed it and what they did. I want to ask a general question before I talk about each of the four projects, and that is, the proponents of urban renewal, under a different name, urban renewal is older. We know that. I was thinking, I think it was Cardinal Richelieu or something. He took down a lot of the walls and barricades from French cities. That's, I think, the 17th century. And then, of course, there's a famous instance of, I guess, what you'd call urban renewal, and that's Haussmann's Reformation of Paris in the mid-19th century. And then there were earlier efforts in the United States. What did the people that were involved in this kind of a wave of urban renewal called just that, urban renewal. What did they want to accomplish, and why did they think this needed to be done in Manhattan?
There is a long history there's, of course, a very long history, as you suggest, to remaking cities. I mean, that's nothing new. It goes back to antiquity.
Yeah.
What we think of as urban renewal, and what I mean by it is very specifically the powers that were unleashed by the 1949 U.S. Housing Act and mm-hmm. Title I, particularly of that act. Now, this act has, as you suggest, also a much longer history. Right? It goes back into the campaigns for slum clearance and public housing and all these things that go back to the turn of the 20th century and pick up steam across the early 20th century. There's the 1937 U.S. Housing Act during the New Deal, which provides federal monies for the construction of public housing. There's all sorts of attempts by all kinds of folks, really, on both sides of the political spectrum and for various reasons to try to intervene in inner cities, right? So on the one hand, you have various castes of urban reformers, so social workers, the quote-unquote housers, right? People who are interested in trying to ease some of the social ills of dense urban living and to help working class people with the conditions and the environment of their lives. And that these people have both sort of benevolent and somewhat paternalistic impulses in wanting to do this. There's all sorts of, there's many long histories of those housing reform efforts. At the same time, across the early 20th century, there are lots of more professional real estate people, people involved in city planning, people involved in particularly just in various facets of downtown real estate development, who would like to restore property values to downtown cities and are worried that as so-called slums and blight spread across the city, that the city is losing its tax base and are already in the early 20th century worrying about the problems of quote-unquote decentralization, which starts to accumulate in the 20s with the first wave of suburbanization, subside a little bit with the New Deal and the war, or sorry, the Depression and the war, but are certainly on people who are paying attention to sort of things' radar, and they're worried that capital is going to leave the city, as it does en masse after World War II. They're worried about this long beforehand. So after World War II, there is an attempt to create a sort of coalition between those who were worried about the social aspects of this, the people who had been the advocates for public housing, the reformers, the quote-unquote housers who had been interested in all kinds of European experiments in social housing, very radical experiments in social housing that had gone on in the 20s and 30s, the kind of classic modernist housing ideas that we think of, the Le Corbusiers, the various German sorts of social housing ideals. But there's those folks. It's a very complicated story, more so than I can get into now, the various factions believing in different things and different ideas. And those folks and the sort of urban real estate people, so folks who are involved in home building, folks who are involved in the construction industry, folks who are really basically concerned to try to keep property values inflated downtown. Now, this is a chancy bargain amongst white people because they have very different interests. Some are much more interested in social problems, and others are much more interested simply in real estate value. And many of those who are interested in real estate value are basically trying to keep property profitable. And to do that, they need a program that isn't just dedicated just to building public housing. Some of them are quite hostile to public housing. Some of them are willing to admit it to this coalition on a sort of junior basis. It's different across the country. Many parts of the country is much more hostile to public housing than New York. I mean, there's been good books written about the sort of the attacks on public housing in other cities across the country, particularly places like Los Angeles and Detroit, places where public housing is seen as quite frankly as socialistic. But what happens is in the late 40s, there's a push at the local level and at the national and federal level to make this bargain happen, to make this coalition happen. And it results through a long period of legal wrangling legal and congressional wrangling, I guess is the right way to put it, in Congress with the 1949 Housing Act. Now, this takes a while, and it's a huge, it sort of fails a couple times in 1946 and 47, and the Congress changes, there's a more conservative Congress comes in, and then a more liberal Congress, and it's finally passed in 49. And there's a huge debate that goes on about it, all over, actually over public housing, over the place of public housing. And it's what I discuss in the book as a battle over the social shape of shelter. And it's about whether or not public housing should be a part of this, the federal government's subsidy for trying to rejuvenate cities. And what happens is that public housing gets in, but in a kind of weakened position. And the coalition that supports the 1949 Housing Act supports most vigorously what is Title I, which is supplying federal money to private rebuilding of cities, mm-hmm. to give local agencies in the city or state level subsidies of various sorts, tax subsidies, other kinds of ways of making it possible for them to go in and clear land in cities and then turn the land over to private redevelopment. So this law ends up being this kind of, has split into a couple different parts, a couple different titles, one of which underwrites private redevelopment, one of which gives money for local housing agencies to build public housing, and all of it is tied together in under this model of slum clearance, of going in and knocking down the old 19th century cityscape and putting up new modern kinds of state-of-the-art urban planning, mm-hmm. this kind of tower in the park ideal. And what everybody shares in this coalition is the idea that that vision of tower in the park, that tower in the park ideal, the open plazas, the taller and austere sort of modern buildings is the proper way to do all this. They've all inherited that kind of vision, an adapted version of it. It should be said there's an American sort of adaptation of European ideals. It's sort of, a lot of people said it's very watered down in the process as it comes out. It's particularly politically watered down in the sense that it no longer necessarily carries with it many of the kinds of social visions mm-hmm. that European, West German, particularly, German social idealism had. So anyway, there is this sort of the emergence of this coalition, of this group of people who want to, on the one hand, try to alleviate the ills of urban living for working in lower and poor, and then on the other hand, it's a group of people who really basically just want to restore property value to make property more profitable in the inner city. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated and unstable coalition that arises out of Title I, and that is also replicated on the local level. So you have like a figure like Robert Moses, who comes out of a background in sort of progressive era reformism, but quickly sees that his bread would be better buttered by making deals with and working along with finance and industry, and he proceeds to do that. Although for many years, he also was not someone who was hostile to public housing. He knew there was a role for public housing to play. So he's one element of this, and a whole group of very varied group of backers and partners that he partnered with to do these kinds of projects. Right. So he did projects with the Rockefellers on the one hand to create Lincoln Center and within Lincoln Square. And that also involved Fordham University and some other major players like that. He worked with hospitals, but he also worked with labor unions. So he worked with a whole host of people, sort of liberals, basically, writ large, sort of liberals on the labor side and liberals on the sort of more Manhattan elite side, mm-hmm. to do these kind of projects, to save particular places where particular institutions had interests. So Columbia University did a ton of urban renewal on Morningside Heights. There are a host of hospitals on the east side. Mount Sinai and Rockefeller did their own. Lincoln Square was the biggest of them where this coalition got together to do Lincoln Center, and Fordham was involved with a campus for the law school there. And then there's other places where labor unions would put together housing, nonprofit sort of housing cooperatives where they would build, for their members, they would build huge, housing projects. There's a huge one still in Chelsea and a number on the Lower East Side. Mm-hmm. So this is the sort of thing that, and the first one, the one that I talk about first, is Stuyvesant Town, which was built with the MetLife housing by the MetLife insurance company, which Metropolitan Life was interested in protecting its investment in downtown New York, and in the early 40s, before the 1949 Housing Act, it partnered with Moses to do this with city and state subsidies, and became a sort of blueprint for what would later become federal urban redevelopment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those kind of institutions that are want to protect their investment in city life, or and want to see urban land remain profitable, that get involved with this. And in the end, this dovetails well with what urban planners have been sort of advocating for many years, which is the kind of movement of factories and industry out of cities, and the retention within cities of white-collar uses. So this was planned for, many urban planners had for Manhattan, and so they became an important part of this coalition as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, in many ways, at the heart of urban renewal, is one part of a larger sort of transformation that sort of gone slowly but with great power over the course of the 20th century to transform New York from an industrial city to a white-collar city. And urban renewal plays a pretty pivotal role in the middle of this process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a good place to start, actually talking about the instances. And I want to begin with the UN, because one of the fascinating things about your book is that you have some nice pictures and the site of the current UN headquarters was a kind of a meatpacking district. It had an abattoir,
right.
And usually, I mean, we have I don't know if this is true or not, but Iowa is certainly one of the centers of meatpacking in North America.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought of Manhattan as being. I knew it had a meatpacking district, but I thought it was gone in the 19th century. So there were major factories. I mean, they're big. They're very big.
Yeah,
and they were wiped out by the UN. Can you tell that story a little bit?
Yeah, sure. A couple things to say about that. I mean, on a couple different levels here. It's important to remember that New York was a very powerful and very vibrant industrial city before the war, and into the years after the war for quite a while. It had a very complicated industrial past that was much different than what we think of, say, a Pittsburgh or a Detroit or a Youngstown, Ohio, or even Cleveland. You know, a place where there wasn't one or two industries that dominated. There were multiple industries, and they were mostly in a small-scale industry, so printing and the garment trade and, small parts industries and all kinds of things that multiplied in the cityscape, particularly of Manhattan and close in and Brooklyn along the water where they could get their goods out to market. And one of the things that was on the East River at Turtle Bay was a small by the standards of Manhattan, but fairly significant collection of slaughterhouses where they would process meat for the local market. This was a really kind of interesting place because it had been it seemed like a place out of another time, I think, in the late 1940s. And this is one of the reasons why it didn't survive, why there wasn't much of a movement to try to save this area, particularly in the face of what was slated to replace it. And that was the United Nations headquarters. And the other thing to say about this is I begin my book with the United Nations headquarters for what may seem like a somewhat odd reason. United Nations headquarters is not actually an urban renewal project, mm-hmm. right? This land is given to, this slaughterhouse land is bought by a real estate developer in the early 1940s, I think it is, William Zeckendorf, who would actually end up being a developer who did tons of urban renewal projects. He did the housing that accompanied the Lincoln Center site. Zeckendorf owned this land, and he was going to do a big futuristic development there after he wiped out all the slaughterhouses, because he assumed, like everyone else, that nobody cared about these slaughterhouses, and why would they? They shouldn't be in Manhattan anyway. According to conventional and contemporary planning opinion, like I was suggesting before, this is the kind of use that was outmoded and was considered a bad use of the land. It wasn't returning the kind of profits it should, and it was smelly and noisome, and nobody wanted it there, it was thought. So he had bought this land, and then he, when it turned out the United Nations was looking for a place to site its headquarters after the war, he gave the land, he sold it for a very sort of fair price to the Rockefellers, who then gifted it to the city and the United Nations to create there for the headquarters. The reason that I write about it is because I think I think what it is it's the kind of the sort of chief and crowning kind of debut of the vision of urban renewal in Manhattan. It's the headquarters site is famously talked about as the first instance in the United States of a glass-walled modernist tower. But what I think is interesting about it is not only that, but that it is also an emblem, and it was talked about at that time, of a new vision for city planning, not just architecture. It was seen as a way to remake city spaces. And so I argue that there was a kind of linked mission that the United Nations symbolized for Manhattan. It was both the idea that New York would be the home to a new vision of global world peace, right? The United Nations, its own stated mission, and the United Nations headquarters complex would symbolize how cities should rebuild to equal that. Cities should be rebuilt, particularly Manhattan, to equal that mission. This vision on order and the sort of built environment of the United Nations itself would somehow be the model for how to rebuild the city around it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not the first urban renewal project. It's not the first modernist project. Citizen Town is actually underway as it's going on. But it gives a kind of charge. It kind of gives a symbolic, it's a very symbolic debut in the early post-war years for what it was imagined urban renewal could do, both domestically and globally. It was a kind of showed how urban renewal and these modernist planning visions could transform both the world and cities. Mm-hmm. And so it was very symbolic in that way. And it had to wipe out this particular small district of slaughterhouses and abattoirs and other, there was some other industry there too. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting place. I mean, there was all kinds of sort of folklore about that place, including the idea, including the fact that because these slaughterhouses were in city blocks, right? They used to use the streets around them as places as herding pens, basically, for the sheep they would be sending. It was mostly sheep they slaughtered there. It wasn't cows. And they had a goat that was used as a kind of herder. He would herd the sheep, and he had a his name was Judas, because he was betraying them all. Right. He would herd them to the slaughterhouse, and people would talk about this. Yeah, so there's some great stories from that, and great ways that it was sort of the ways that the loss of this slaughterhouse district was seen. And this was something that was continually rehearsed again and again over the years in different urban renewal sites. This was the way that the slaughterhouse could be seen as a kind of part of the past that would be necessarily sacrificed, and its sacrifice would ennoble it because it would be giving way for something that would be greater than it, right? So it was depicted in various media from that period as something that was obviously outmoded, and its significance now was in the fact that it would give way for a better use and a higher use. And this would be repeated many, many times. And that only became a problem when you asked people themselves to feel that way about themselves, to suggest that people themselves should feel good because they were part of the wreckage of their lives was part of something greater. They were not really going to. The only way they would partake in it was to make way for it. And that came to be the way that people began to feel about this later on, say at Lincoln Center or at some of the other clearance sites. There weren't very many people who lost their livelihood at the UN site. And yeah, it was only later.
Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of sheep that did.
Yeah. They were used to that. They were doing that all the time.
They were doing that all the time. It's true. So let's talk about Stuyvesant a little bit. This is a place that I imagine many, many of our listeners have seen. I remember I've been in it, wandered through it, and wondered about it. Where did it come from?
Well, Stuyvesant Town is interesting. I mean, I bet many of your listeners grew up there. I run into people who grew up in Stuyvesant Town all the time. It happens, like, constantly. There were thousands and thousands of people living there, and they've gone on to do lots of interesting things and become part of the world. Many years. It's a fascinating place that continues to be this kind of imaginatively grand part of New York life, even though it occupies a relatively small part of the acreage of the island. And today it's of course this great symbol for the real estate and the financial crisis because it was the biggest real estate bust in the history of mankind. I guess when it was bought by a massive real estate company from MetLife, and then who has recently defaulted on it. And its fate is in jeopardy. And it's controversial because it was, of course, seen as this kind of last holdout of middle-class life in Manhattan, where everything has gone so upscale and so luxury, which is ironic because its history is that of a middle-class district, yes, but replacing a working class district. Mm-hmm. And it was very much debated in those terms in the late 40s when it was being built, in the mid 40s when it was planned and the late 40s when it was built. Sizentown emerges from the need during World War II of Mayor LaGuardia and Robert Moses to find a way to get private capital into the slum clearance and new housing game. They had during the Depression and the New Deal been able to get federal monies to build a bunch of public housing. New York and Manhattan and Brooklyn mostly built the most public housing of any city during the New Deal. But they thought that the scope of the problem was so high that they were going to need private money to get involved. But private money wouldn't get involved because they didn't want to lose their shirt on chancy real estate deals, chancy investments in real estate in urban land that they didn't think they would pay. So they needed much higher levels of subsidy than were able to be offered. Gradually over time, the state and city governments were able to offer something that at least MetLife was willing to take a risk on. And MetLife was willing to take a risk on this because they also saw themselves as needing to shore up their investments in downtown Manhattan, where they were based, and because they saw many of their policyholders were people that lived in and around, and they thought this would be a good investment in a sort of symbol of how to rebuild cities. So they planned this. They had built in the late 30s and early 40s a big housing development in the Bronx called Perpchester, which is another kind of place like Sizentown, middle sort of lower middle class kind of place that wasn't built out of an old neighborhood. That was on open land. Sizentown would be different and new because it would be the biggest slum clearance project yet. It would knock out a whole area of the Lower East Side between 14th and 23rd Street west of First Avenue. That had been called the Gas House District, a name that is gone from almost everybody's memories of the history of New York, which is a pretty well-known place back then. It was the sort of northern tier of the Lower East Side before there was a term, the East Village. And in fact, I think in many ways the creation of Sizentown north of 14th Street creates this little pocket of the city that could become the East Village in the 60s when it became sort of part of that, when it became adopted by the counterculture. Because you didn't want to go above 14th Street because that was this sort of boring, middle-class, modern family life. Below 14th Street was still the old Lower East Side and being transformed to East Village. Anyway, so Sizentown, it was planned, cooperation between city-state funds announced in 1943 by LaGuardia and Moses and the MetLife head, a guy named Frederick Ecker. It was built after the war. In that area of Lower East Side, and was occupied in 1949 by many veterans. Veterans had preference. There was a huge housing shortage in Manhattan in these years, and so it was seen as this kind of great sort of a gift, you know, this great symbol of the hope and possibility of the post-war era when it sort of seemed to descend into this old neighborhood. But it was controversial for the people who had lived in this neighborhood, people who lost their homes to the wrecking ball, but not controversial enough that anyone could stop it or anyone could turn it back. It was seen as too much a part of a post-war plan for hope. It was still that coalition between business and real estate and sort of social reformers was still in place. They all more or less supported Sizentown. And so it went forward. Now, the big thing that it was, the most important controversy surrounding Sizentown was along lines of color, race. The Sizentown was segregated, and it, like any private landlord, MetLife believed that they had the right to choose who could live in their house, and they didn't want to admit African Americans because they thought it would destroy their property values, and so they didn't. And so that kicked off a huge battle, one of the first battles of the Northern Civil Rights Movement, the sort of lost civil rights history that is only recently being sort of retold by historians. Thomas DeGruy's big book, Sweet Land of Liberty, and a number of other books about the Northern Civil Rights Movement. Size of Town is a huge part of this attempt to desegregate the housing complex. It was led by African Americans and leftists within the complex, and it was eventually successful, and MetLife backed down and allowed African Americans in, although never in any great numbers, and it wasn't until the 60s and 70s really, until Size and Town was at all in any way really integrated. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the big things. But at the same time, it was a place that the reason I was interested in it was because it was the blueprint for urban renewal policies, writ large, for federal urban renewal policies, in a sense of how that compact would be made, how the deal would be made. And it was also kind of a social blueprint for what the controversies surrounding urban renewal would be, both in terms of the relocation and also in terms of the way people thought about these new spaces. Because the people who moved into Stuyvesant in town, whether they were involved with the desegregation controversy or not, there were, I maybe didn't mention this quite precisely enough, many of the people who campaigned against desegregation were Stuyvesant Town residents, people who lived there already and thought that it was a shame that their home was discriminatory, and they really led the charge by a campaign of civil disobedience by allowing African American civil rights activists to live in their apartments and things like that. So many of those people, whether they were involved with that or not, took to heart the idea that what they were doing was trying to make a new kind of space in the city, a kind of new middle-class landscape. And it was the problem for them was that this was a mass landscape. It was a landscape of mass homes that were identically produced, and that was troubling to many people. They worried about the impact and the what it meant that they were living in a house in an apartment building that was sort of constructed in this kind of factory-like style that seemed to be one sort of set of boxes after another. Now, this wasn't too terrible for many New Yorkers because they were used to living in apartment buildings. They were used to living in high-rises. But these, again, as you suggested, these high-rises looked like the public housing that was going up, right? They looked like something that might be lived in a far more regimented political culture. People said they looked like barracks. They said, how can you stand to live there? People were very... there was a lot of controversy around it. And many... Stuyvesanters defended their own living there. They said, look, it gives us access to open space, that there's a lot of light and air. Many of them loved it, but they had to fight both amongst themselves and against sort of public perceptions of the project, this sort of battle, this sort of struggle within the realm of meaning over what it meant to live in this kind of what I call a mass cityscape for middle-class living. And that was very interesting to see that emerge from the sources that I found in the MetLife archives. All these debates over what authority the MetLife itself had over their lives, debates over what parts of the emerging consumer economy they could participate in, and how MetLife and other parts of the consumer economy, department stores in particular, sold Stuyvesant Town as part of this new post-war consumer economy. So on the one hand, as part of the sort of boom, as almost like an in-town Levittown, a kind of suburban boom, although people, of course, there didn't own their, these were all rentals, they weren't owning, so ownership was a little bit different there. But it was sort of part of this sort of vision of the good life on the one hand, and on the other hand, it was this place that was this kind of mass space that everyone had to sort of negotiate and figure out how to live in. And so that kind of tension between freedom and authority is one of those things that was kind of established in this, in the way that people received the world of Stuyvesant Town would echo down the years through various other in various other places that urban renewal reconstructed in various different kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. So that's the Stuyvesant Town.
Yeah, let's move on to Lincoln Center then, because I think many people have seen it as well, and maybe been to a concert or something there. I know I have, and I've always wondered how it got there. Now, I mean, I know, but maybe you could tell us.
Yeah, Lincoln Center was the heart, the sort of centerpiece of a larger urban renewal project called the Lincoln Square Urban Renewal Project. I think Lincoln Square is again one of these words that has, or terms for an area that has a bit faded. Lincoln Square is the area around where Lincoln Center is, 60th Street and North on the Upper West Side along Columbus and Amsterdam Avenues. Broadway and that sort of triangle area in there. It was an area that was quite kind of run down by the 1940s and 50s. It was an area that had seen a lot of transition and change, a lot of decline in its housing stock, a lot of combinations of old row houses and middle-class sort of row houses into rooming houses and apartment houses. It was it had been seen a whole population of African-Americans move in the early part of the 20th century and then move out to Harlem in the 20s, and had recently started to see in the post-war era a huge influx of Puerto Ricans. So it was a neighborhood that was really undergoing a lot of change, was in a lot of flux. And it, through various different means, became a place that Robert Moses targeted as a new home for the Metropolitan Opera, which needed to move from its home at Carnegie Hall and was looking for a new place to locate. And so by various different means, by which I won't go into too much detail, a number of different arts organizations decided to band together and be a part of this move and take Moses up on his offer to relocate. And they wanted to create this great arts center. And so they created Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, which was headed by John D. Rockefeller III, who wanted to try to expand his family's interest in philanthropy to urban redevelopment, and saw he was the sort of visionary behind this idea that the arts would play a new role in city rebuilding, which has of course become a massive theme in city rethinking. But Lincoln Center was one of the major places to start this. And they attracted, and Moses helped them put them together with Fordham University and a couple other institutional anchors, and they created the Lincoln Square Urban Renewal Project, which was very consciously seen as the kind of crowning jewel of urban renewal in New York, the most high-minded of all urban renewal undertakings, the most sort of exalted of them, and also the biggest. It was, in terms of space, square footage up to that point, the biggest. It was seen as being led by very responsible project sponsors, mm-hmm. unlike some other urban renewal projects, which had been mired in all sorts of really kind of tawdry corruption scandals in terms of sort of real estate corruption scandals. And it was fairly well run. It targeted this area where Lincoln Center is now, plus a sort of cluster of blocks that to the northwest of the Lincoln, where Lincoln Center is today, running from 60th Street, where Fordham would be, up through the Lincoln Center site, and then across 65th, where Juilliard is now, and then running west, almost to the river, where there was a whole a host of big housing, more like a luxury housing development put in there called Lincoln Towers, which was planned, right, as I mentioned, by William Zeckendorf. So it was planned in the early 1950s and went through a huge amount of delays because of the resistance, which I'll talk about in a second, and then was finally built over the course of sort of 1959 to the late 60s in stages. And it remade that part of the Upper West Side and really, I think, in many ways, jump-started the boom in the Upper West Side. It was the sort of energies that Lincoln Center let off, helped to fuel the gentrification of the Upper West Side that would proceed over the next 20 to 30 years. I think it's hard to remember, but many people don't know, but in the 50s and 60s, the Upper West Side was not a place that people would have just thought of as fashionable or as the kind of place where anyone wanted to go. In fact, there's great stories about the people in Stuyvesant Town, over on the east side, when they were being relocated, asked where they might want to relocate. Well, they all said they wanted to relocate right nearby because that was where they're familiar with, but they said as long as it's not on the west side, because the west side was, of course, seen as that was actually seen as a step down from parts of the east side, the lower east side. So, places like Hell's Kitchen and even north of that, all of the west side was seen as quite a problem. But this, the Lincoln Center was the sort of bid to reclaim that and helped to lay the groundwork for that gentrification. So, mm-hmm. And it was also, the thing that was really interesting about it to me was the way that Lincoln Center in particular was sold as a kind of part of this, was sort of the highest moment where the sort of Cold War logic of urban renewal came to fruition. It came to be really publicly, not just debated, but publicly really pitched. It was pitched as a kind of part of showing America's cultural maturity to the world. This is the way the sponsors of Lincoln Center pitched it and the way people discussed it. It was seen as a way to show that the United States was ready to meet the challenges of the post-war world, of global dominance, of its role in leading the free world. And then people talk quite explicitly about this, from Rockefeller to other people who are involved in the organization that created Lincoln Square. People like C.D. Jackson, who was the publisher of The Time of Fortune, this great big sort of conglomeration of elites across some divisions in New York society. There were Jewish and Catholic and Anglo or sort of WASP folks who worked together on this. To really create this kind of bastion of high-minded liberal city rejuvenation was the idea, and so Lincoln Center was sold in this way, and sold in this ideal of a city remaking, high-minded city remaking for a new post-war and Cold War era. But what they didn't foresee was that the people who lived there in Lincoln Square would not see their sacrifices in quite the same light. And what's interesting about what happened at Lincoln Square is that Lincoln Square is the place where resistance to urban renewal first made a kind of noisy debut on the public stage. It wasn't the first place where urban renewal had met resistance, but it was the first place where that resistance began to gain some kind of a public hearing and some kind of a public, got really into the public eye, I guess you might say. And that was in part because by 1956 and 57, when the resistance really took off, there was starting to be some grumbling behind the scenes and in some quarters of New York life that perhaps Robert Moses had gone too far. There had been corruption at a number of his sites. There had been a lot of controversy over relocation because relocation from these highway building sites and urban renewal sites and all the different places where there was construction and clearance going on. Because what it seemed to be happening, and nobody could really prove this, but it seemed to be more and more the case that Moses would confidently tell everyone, and the New York City Housing Authority would agree, because he basically controlled the Housing Authority, that there was plenty of housing to go around and plenty of units for everybody who was being displaced. But it turned out that he was probably just recycling the same numbers to use at every individual site. And then the individual clearances far surpassed, or relocatees, dislocatees, far surpassed the number of available units in public housing and in what could be estimated by the real estate industry existed in private housing. And so this had started to build. And the Lincoln Center resistance, which was led by a group of, there was two groups there. There was one that represented the homeowners or the renters, the tenants, basically. There were some homeowners, but it was mostly tenants. And then people who represented the businesses there, small businesses there, who grouped together under one umbrella organization. And they really capitalized on this. And they hired a guy who is also a somewhat unjustly forgotten figure, still alive today, a man named Harris Present, who was a lawyer who's now in his mid-90s. And he campaigned, he helped them to sort of get their message out there. He had been involved with a number of different social reform agencies over the years as a lawyer, as a pro bono lawyer, and he had actually been involved with a body seeking to reform relocation policies for urban renewal and public housing. And he became very disillusioned with that process and wanted to move to a far more aggressive stance in trying to press the mayor, Mayor Wagner, and Moses to do something about these problems. And so he saw as an opportunity linking up with the Lincoln Square folks, because this would be a high-profile battle if they could tap into the fact that here was this great big institution of culture planned for a place that was threatened by this. And so they did, and they were able to really get onto the front pages of the papers, get their images in the paper, get quoted in a way that nobody had ever been before. I mean, before this, there had been little rumblings, but most folks who were being relocated from urban renewal sites, if they protested, they were really only heard by really the left-wing press. They were really only given much time in those press. There's a little bit here and there in the bigger papers, but it's largely because they were championed by movements that were connected to the Communist Party in various ways, and the various left parties in the city of those years. And those folks had really jump-started a movement, It was the folks at Lincoln Square who came along from a bit more of a centrist position, but which moved left as things went along, so to speak, moved and got more radical as things went along, who were able to bring it to a larger citywide audience. And it really started getting attention in the Times and in the Herald Tribune and the other major papers. There have been a couple papers, like the New York Post, which was a liberal paper then, which before it was owned by a very crusading liberal family before what's his name had descended from England. So they were able to get this out to many people. Now they failed, of course, but they were able to make an argument, which I was very interested in, was that their world, the social world that they inhabited in this streetscape of Lincoln Center, in this neighborhood of Lincoln Square, was the equal in cultural terms to that on offer at Lincoln Center. It was a bottom-up model of culture, but it was as equal and as valuable as the top-down version of high culture that would be represented at Lincoln Center. And they really made an interesting argument about this by showing how there was this whole cultural world that was a sort of a world that was yoked together, public and private, right? Their homes, their businesses, this all worked together in this kind of urban network, right? And they were, in many ways, rehearsing the ideas that would later come to become so influential and so inspiring when they were articulated in a far more dramatic and literary fashion, and convincing fashion by Jane Jacobs. They were sort of rehearsing some of these ideas, trying to figure out what it was about their world that could equal the vision on hand and on offer from Lincoln Center. Now, they weren't able to turn back that project, and they weren't able to undo it, but they were able to show that there was a real world there. There wasn't just this sort of benighted slum world that was just a series of statistics that needed rectifying. They said, this is a world that that consists of real people in their lives. There are businesses here. There's a whole social a dense ecology of life. They wouldn't have used those terms, but mm-hmm. those would be terms that would be used by Jacobs later.
Mm-hmm.
That was what was really interesting about Lincoln Square to me. This is the place where resistance to urban renewal first rears its head in a significant way, not only in terms of its social impact, but in terms of its cultural impact, in terms of the meanings that would later come to really unseat urban renewal, to replace urban renewal as a vision of urbanism, right? An entirely different understanding of what it means to live urban life and how one might nurture urban life that Jacobs was so powerful in describing and that rehearsed at Lincoln Square.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about the last case very briefly if we can, because we're about out of time. And that would again, this cityscape that you see when you're coming down from New Haven on Metro North.
Yeah. Well, that's East Harlem, and East Harlem was I included in the book because it's the most densely redeveloped neighborhood by way of public housing. It's where some people argue that maybe we should be looking, if you say that, you should be looking at the Lower East Side or at Brownsville, Brooklyn, or other places. But East Harlem was one of the places where people were most took notice of the fact that what happens to a neighborhood when it's transformed almost solely by public housing, by the New York City Housing Authority. I think I described earlier the way that public housing was a kind of junior partner to urban renewal in these campaigns to remake cities. And so public housing was damaged by this, the fact of its being a junior partner. But in New York, there had always been an active public housing lobby and an active public housing movement. And so they had quite a bit more power than many other cities to build. And they did actively build, and they actively saw what they were doing as trying to build for people. But what happened was is that the density of this rebuilding got to be so much that many people on the ground in East Harlem started to look around and say, look, is this really what we wanted? I mean, almost everybody supported it in the late 40s and early 50s. By the mid-50s, there started to be a lot of questioning, and not the least by a group of characters that I became really interested in, who were a group of social workers who had been involved with many of the neighborhood settlement houses there, who had called in the 30s, 40s, and in the early 50s for more public housing. And they continued to think that public housing was a good idea, but they weren't so sure that just these sort of monolithic culture of all public housing was such a good idea. So what they did is they began to advance new ideas about redesigning public housing and introducing more mixed income and maybe even some mixed income or middle, actually more like middle income projects into the middle of this, sometimes urban renewal projects that were more based for middle income folks, so that they could restore some of the diversity to the neighborhood that they had seen there before, where you had a much more mixed cityscape of proprietors of stores living next to working families and poor families, and whereas in public housing you just simply had these kind of monocultures of families with children who were lower income, not quite poor because really poor people couldn't afford public housing, but also not too wealthy because if you got too wealthy then you had to move out of public housing. So anyway, they introduced a whole set of reforms that tried to rethink public housing from the perspective of the city street rather than the tower and the plaza, and they tried to introduce some redesigns that knitted the landscape of public housing and new public housing designs back into the city streets in various ways. They were aided in this by Jane Jacobs, who was on the board of the Union Settlement House and became part of the efforts of the East Harlem Project, an early community organizing effort there, to try to do some of this work. And so she got some of her early inspiration from working with the social workers of East Harlem and a planner by the name of Albert Meyer, who was really influential in this. So there were a number of folks in East Harlem who helped Jacobs. A woman by the name of Ellen Lurie was particularly influential there. Mildred Zucker was another. And they all tried to rethink urban renewal as it's on its physical impact. And this had various interesting implications for East Harlem. The social workers themselves actually never really wanted to give up public housing. They thought it was a good idea. They just didn't want so much of it, and they wanted to rethink how it impacted the city. But what it ended up doing in the long run was introduce and give impetus to this rethinking of urban renewal and urban and modern planning that would drive Jacobs' efforts. And so then I end the book by suggesting that all this turmoil at these different places sort of combines in the moment in the early 1960s when Jacobs both leads resistance to urban renewal in Greenwich Village and releases her book, which galvanizes all these disparate movements into a larger movement that ends up unseating urban renewal as sort of state-of-the-art, de rigueur, common-sense form of city remaking and replaces it with a different set of ideas.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that very briefly. Can you tell us what different set of ideas that was? Is the era of these large housing blocks of the – I always think of them as the Soviet style. Is it over?
Right. The modernist tower block, that's replaced by a vision in which we plan from the idea of mixed use streetscapes. We plan from the idea of short blocks. These are sort of some of Jacobs's big ideas, all of which has become common sense in planning and architecture today. What didn't go out was sort of relying upon the private real estate market as the driver of development, and so that's caused a host of problems. But you know, the era of the tower in the park is largely over, although you have actually seen in recent years some return to some of this sort of vision of modernism. Modernism came back into fashion over the last 10 or 15 years in some interesting ways. And so it's not dead entirely. It was dead for the 60s, for the 70s and the 80s, I think. So, you know, there's been some interesting sort of implications of that in planning and architecture. I'm mostly interested in the way that this was the sort of moment in which urban renewal kind of had really interesting effects, and I've wanted to kind of complicate our understanding of urban renewal as just this sort of evil thing that was left in history. Yeah. It's in part, I don't think we need to rejuvenate it necessarily, but I do think that it had interesting and complicated effects. I mean, it opened up the city for all kinds of new forms of development. The towers in the park, 30, 40 years on, don't seem quite so evil as they've blended more into the cityscape around them. They've really preserved some room in the city for middle-income people, right? I mean, there's a reason why Sizemore kind of celebrated as this kind of refuge in the city, rather than now it's a place where in a overbuilt, very expensive city, middle-income people can still have a little bit of a hold. There's a lot of public housing in the middle of the city, and that's all due to this era, the remaking of this era. Yeah. So, I wanted to see it as both a part of not the fall of New York necessarily, but this transformation of New York into a world city, a white-collar city on the one hand, and also causing these problems of the urban crisis. So a complicated story, more so than we've had in the past, all part of this sort of domestic culture of the Cold War that had such interesting and complicated implications.
Yeah, I was just reminded, actually, while you were talking of an expression that every New Yorker knows. I didn't know it before I moved to New York. I only lived there about a year and a half, and but it is pre-war building.
No one will know
what that is if they haven't lived in New York. Pre-war building. Right. Yeah, that's like a thing. Right, I live in a pre-war building, and it's and your book does a lot to kind of to explain why that small and inscrutable phrase is important for New Yorkers. Anyway, Sandy, thanks very much for being on the show. I want to ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I've got two projects going, one a sort of short-term thing and one a long-term thing. One is a couple of essays, maybe a book, I don't know, about visions of what I call popular internationalism, seeing during and after World War II, people who envisioned a new role for the United States in the world before the Cold War sort of foreclosed such kind of utopian or, I don't know, adventurous thinking. So I've written a piece on E.B. White and his thinking on world government, which is referenced a little bit in the U.N. section of the book. Actually, that's where I was inspired to think about it. And I'm thinking of writing also about Wendell Willkie and his book One World. Got something coming on that. And then I've got a long-term project that is far more complicated and far more that I call the city and the self, and it's about thinking about the relations, the intellectual relationships and practical relationships between development of metropolitan spaces and conceptions of selfhood, which I will leave hanging.
Well, it all sounds super interesting to me, and I hope we get a chance to talk to you about it when these projects come to fruition. And so I'll just say thank you very much for the book. It was very interesting to talk to you today, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Sandy Zipp about his book, Manhattan Projects, The Rise and Fall of Urban Renewal in Cold War New York. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.